Exception number 9574, reel 3.
I was transferred to the 1st 5th Loyal North Lancs, and I went out to France again, and we were doing odd jobs here and there, looking after railway garages or whatever you like to call them, as troops were being demobilised and they were looting on these trains, with French Canadians more or less, and they think nothing of putting a bullet through a barrel of alcohol or rum or anything of that description, you know. But anyway, we were put on there for a time, and then we went to La Bassée, more or less guarding German prisoners and so on until...
What was it like guarding the German prisoners? Can you tell me more about that?
Well, they used to go to the compound, and you'd be allotted so many prisoners, probably 30, 40, 50. You'd check the number that you were taking out, and then you'd put them in a working party or something like that. And because there were still, you know, plenty of cleaning up to do. And then...
What sort of cleaning up? You mean in the battlefield area?
Oh, yes. I mean, the... such as La Bassée Canal and that sort of thing, there must have been dozens of people drowned in there, you know, at one time or the other. Well, they were clearing the canal out, and more or less the any wounded or anything like that, any person that had been killed, probably. I mean, you can't go into details of rotting bodies and all that sort of thing and so on, but anyway, from La Bassée, after the Germans had gone home, we more or less came, we were devolved. So really, I've not much more to tell you.
I'd just like now to ask you a couple of questions. We left them out earlier for convenience, about the conditions that, you know, while you were below the Passchendaele Ridge. You've told us about the shape of the trench and everything. Was the trench very disrupted at that time? Was it a clear-cut, well-defined trench?
Oh, no, there were different bays, but they weren't clean and tidy or anything of that description. I mean, you could stand on the firing step, and if you stepped off the firing step, you'd be stood in water, you know. More or less all the trenches at that particular time of the year, which was more or less... Well, it was early spring, wasn't it? And there'd be plenty of sludge and water, which was everywhere. There's no, not only in the trenches, but on the main roads and all sorts.
How deep were they?
What, the trenches? Well, on the firing step, you could stand on the firing step and see over. But
how did they keep the walls up with all the water and the mud? The sides of the trench. Did they have anything to keep it up, or was it just the...
Oh, you were dug into the soil, you know. It wasn't on the roads, on the surface.
I just mean the sides of the trenches below the surface.
Oh, it used to be more or less sloping and that sort of thing. It was more or less rectangular, as you might say.
You mentioned one dugout, that German dugout that you couldn't stay. Did you have any dugouts dug into the side walls of the trenches?
No, not in that. Not in the. There was in the front line. That was the one in Passchendaele. But the old line that we dug up just in front of the Menin Road, That was more or less straight. I tell you, we were an old line, and they waited until we dug it up, we'd straightened it up a bit before they started shelling, you know. Because I know it stand down this particular night, he started shelling. And he seemed to knock off for breakfast. As though he was knocking off for breakfast. And then he started up again.
Where would you sleep in these trenches? You know?
Well, in the old line that we took over after we came out of Passchendaele, that was the little bivouacs there.
But what about when you were up right at the front?
Oh,
were
you? If you didn't use these pillboxes that the Germans had already built, I mean, there were, I don't know how much concrete was on the top of you, you know, but they were only more or less squares, as it might be this room here. From this end to there. I mean, you can just imagine being about 18 inches and crawling in, and then your other body's in there, but there was no ventilation at all except the opening.
What about your rations and your water supplies? What were they like while you were up? I'm thinking particularly while in the front line and those outposts.
Well, you always had a water bottle, you know, with you, and I don't remember any difficulty at all. I mean, with rations and all that sort of thing, we used to get a hot meal, I suppose, when they could get the rations up to the front line.
Even right up to the front when you were right in the outpost and at the front line, you got hot meal.
I don't know where it came from. It was brought up, and I more or less just took the rations up, well, helped to take the rations up, but I know I brought up the rear and had this container full of soup. Oh, it would be about that big, you know, and it was just like a valise that it just slipped your arms through and it fastened around your waist. God, it never knows, if I'd have fell off this duckboard, I don't know what would have happened then.
What about tinned food? Did you get a lot of tinned food or bread or anything like that?
Ah, McConaughey's. There were plenty of McConaughey's.
What did you think of
that? Oh, that was all right. It's only there were beef, beans, potatoes, and you could get any old tin and put it on them, or open the tin and put it in boiling water, and you got a hot meal then. But bully beef, jam, and all this sort of thing. Certain commodities as young were scarce.
Did you get enough to eat while you're at the front?
Well, you know what a soldier is. You can put him down to a meal, and he'll have a proper good meal probably an hour afterwards he's famished. But as far as I can remember, the meals were all right. They were rough, but there were plenty of them.
What about the health factors? About latrines, did you have any sort of latrine arrangements?
They had when you came down the line, they more or less what I see about it, you would dig a hole, pull boards across it, you know, so that you sit on it, and then when it got reasonably full, they'd just dig another hole and put what they call it on it.
Would you have that in the line?
you do it anywhere in the line. You might have been tied down to some places, but on the other hand, you wouldn't do it anywhere. Where you were standing, you wouldn't think, well, you might get into a corner somewhere out of the way, and probably other people had used that, don't they? They didn't do it, if you can understand me, they didn't do it all over the place.
There weren't latrines of any sort that you could recognise. It was just certain areas where you'd go.
If you were down the line, but I mean, you had to manage anyway. You do it. I suppose you do it on a paper, a piece of cardboard, or something like that, and then sling it to a bloody trench. I don't know, but I mean, if people wanted to go anywhere, they couldn't very well jump out of the trench and go and get in a shell or something like that.
What about, would you be expected to keep clean or to shave or to keep uniform tidy while you're in the front line? Was there any pretense of keeping up appearances?
Well, anybody who think or thought about himself at all, he tried to his best to keep clean, but there was so much sludge knocking about that I can't understand how anyone could stop being clean. I mean, if they found any water at all, they'd have a wash. If there were no water there, and they'd only got drinking water, they'd prefer to drink it than wash the face in it.
What about lice? Any problems with lice?
In what way?
Lice. But I mean, did the troops get did they get lice, or did you get lice?
Oh, no, I didn't. There might have been one or two fleas or anything like that, I don't know. But from what they tell me, they used to sit on these latrines and run a candle up down the seam.
But you had no problem?
I wasn't there long enough to. I don't think to develop such.
What about rats? Were there many rats in that front line?
There was only one in outpost, and half asleep on the fire step, we were watching out one night, and something went across my arm here, and it could have been a cat, it could have been anything, but there were definitely rats out there. There's no doubt about that, and there's no doubt about they fed on the corpses, you know. That's the only one I ever came across, anyway.
Are there many dead bodies around in this area still remaining unburied?
To tell you the truth, I never saw anyone. I'm telling a lie. Before we went up to Passchendaele, we was in a little place, I don't know what it was, but we went to have a look at shell had burst, and this lad had been hit in the face with a piece of shrapnel. We went to more or less see if we could recognise him, but we couldn't recognise him at all. And apart from being on the coming from the front line, when I went to the battalion dressing station, there were very few that I saw, even wounded. But on different sections, as I tell you, at Passchendaele there, that the sergeant major and what and this a corporal of the platoon, when they came, he said they'd been wiped out except for those that had been taken prisoner.
There'd been a German attack.
Oh, there was one lad who used to go to school with me at the same time. They called him Brammer, and he was in the same platoon as me, and I knew his sister anyway, as well as she worked at Sharman's in Glossop Road, and she was a friend of the wife's sister. Anyway, she got word through that he'd been killed, and naturally she were cut up about it. But after the armistice had been signed and they were liberating the prisoners, he came home and he went into Sharman's, and she'd more or less mourned him as dead, but he'd been taken prisoner. And of course, I mean, it was a relief to her, also a shock.
What was your health like? Now, I know you weren't there long, but while you were there, did you stay healthy?
I could always eat and sleep.
What was a sort of typical day like? Can you remember when you? I know you weren't in the front line for long, but while you were there, you said you had stand two, did you, in the morning?
Well, you always stood two. Everybody, I mean, those that were resting, when you stood two at night, you stood to for if there was it came over the top. But And as soon as the darkness had gone, you stand down, you see. And it was the same in the morning. You stand to at daylight, at dusk anyway, until it got daylight.
And then what would you do during the day? What sort of things did you get? Would you do?
I couldn't tell you at all. I mean,
you were a Lewis gunner. What would you have to do?
Well, we'd always see that the gun was in working order, didn't we? But apart from that, if you were down the line, you got to clean yourself up, you know. And
I mean, in the line more.
Oh well, you just take things as they come, and more or less, if Jerry were to come over, and but
did he ever do that while you were there?
No, no.
What about during the night? What would you do during the? Would you have any working parties out then for covering parties, raids, reconnaissance patrol?
I never went on a raid anyway. I heard that they used to cut barbed wire. They cut the barbed wire and that sort of thing, you know. But if there was going to be a over the top business in them the following day, but. Very often they used to put a barrage up or something like that to counter that.
Now, the last thing really, the sort of routine fighting. It doesn't sound like there were a lot of casualties while you were there until just after you were wounded. Was there much artillery or mortar fire? Not at the range, like you said, but was there much artillery?
Well, you see, if you're in an outpost, the whether it was, whether you were a corporal or a sergeant or whatever, and there were a machine gun that was continually firing in one particular place, he'd probably get in touch with the company commander and tell them about it. Or you could mark it on the sandbag on top of the fire step. They'd probably mark when it was dark. You could see the firing of the gun, you know. It probably put a mark where it was, and he'd be able to tell the commander, and then he'd probably get into what they call it and tell him about this machine gun that was firing. You'd probably notice for two or three nights, you see. Then you'd more or less get in touch with the artillery, and it put a couple of whiz bangs over. You see, the whiz bang, he used to explode above the trench, and they were all like a lot of steel marbles that used to shoot out of it, and it used to spray the trench. So they'd but as I say, I wasn't there so long that
you didn't get much artillery fire on you on your line while you were there.
Oh no, that was the most. While we were in the inside Passchendaele, we hardly saw any gunfire at all, except machine gun fire, that's all, such as artillery fire.
There wasn't much sniping either.
No. There were nothing to. There were all the trees or whatever there was that had been standing, they were off, more or less cut down, you know.
How did the fighting affect you? Did it affect your nerves much?
No. I wasn't there long enough. Probably, if I'd been there 3 or 4 years, it might have done, but really it was surprising. You don't notice it until you're coming down the line, and then you see people and you think, you're doing all this sort of thing, you know. And it's the first start of a shell shock, you know. There's no control in it at all, you know. It's just same as a bloke having a stroke. His legs go and.
And your lot were nearly all new out, though, you know, your company. Was there anybody in that lot showing signs of nerves?
Not while I was there. Even a sergeant that put bandage around my leg when I came out of this trench, he said, "I'll give you 50 quid for it."
For the wound. So people were already wanted. That was the attitude of a blind.
Oh, but I never anticipated, as I say, I never anticipated getting to Blighty, and I think it was the kindness of this doctor, I could tell you his name, the kindness of this doctor. And I thought, when he said that, how old are you, sonny? And I told him, I think he thought it was just bad enough to more or less get to, although there were an old a jock there, he must be been 30, 40, between 30 and 40 anyway, and he'd had a bullet right through the cheek of his behind, you know, and he was still waiting to be wounded. He was only flesh wound anyway. But
what about your rest periods while you were there? When you came out of the line, what would you do during rest periods? You mentioned you had to tidy yourself up. Would that include polishing your buttons?
Oh yeah, you'd have to make yourself presentable, even washing your putties and that sort of thing, you're cleaning your shoes. And
so it was a return to spit and polish?
More or less.
Did you resent that at all?
No, anybody who thinks who thought about himself, the cleanliness is what they call it, it's to godliness, isn't it? I mean, it's up to a bloke himself to keep himself clean. Otherwise, I mean, if he's going to deteriorate to such an extent, I mean, he might as well pack it in altogether.
What did you do for relaxation? Could you go to local estaminets? Were you pulled far enough back for that?
No, I don't remember much about estaminets until I went out to France after the armistice was signed. Then we used to go into the, you know, der shop a couple of years, or Pomme de terre free Savic or something like that, Deux Oeufs, so on. Apart from that, I don't think I ever went into I never got a chance to go into an estaminet anyway, until after the armistice was signed.
When you, going right back now to that, when you were demobilised, what did you do when you got back into civilian life? Did you get a job easily?
Oh, no. I went to I was working with my brother at the one that was killed, by the way, in 1916. The 12th of December 1916 he was killed. He joined the York and Lancs on the 12th of December 1916. That's when he was killed. He joined the force in January 1916, and he just what is it? He hadn't 12 months in the army anyway. He did six months training. Oh, was it 3 months training? I don't know. I think it was 6 months training, and he'd been in France 3 months, or vice versa. I don't really remember. And from what I could gather, because the York and Lancs is a Sheffield battalion, you know. Has it nearly finished? It was a Sheffield battalion, and there were a lot of people that I knew, shopkeepers and all that, that joined the City Battalion at the same time as my brother Harry. And they said he was out of the line at the time, and he was drinking a mug of tea, cocoa or something, and a shell exploded outside and a piece of shrapnel hit him full in the face. He says that's how he died. And December the 12th, that's when he was killed. I know my mother got she got word on New Year's morning in 1917.
And after the war, you were telling me how you got work.
I went to see my old job. My brother and my he got me the job anyway. Because I told you I didn't go to the stores. Where are our lad, because it was too far away. Anyway, he got me a job there at this cap manufacturer's. We used to press the seams and all this sort of thing, and caps and so on. It was only a light job, but it was a clean job, wasn't it? And when he went, I took over what he was doing, you see, until I decided to go in the army. And then when I came back again, I went to see it had been taken over. It were clean, but it were clean Rothwell. It had been more or less got into a partnership or something. Anyway, he says, I can only give you the same money as you were getting when you left. That was 30 bob a week, which was nothing. I said, I went as a lad. I said, well, I've come as a man, you know. So he says, well, he says, that's all I can do for you. So anyway, I said, that's no good to me. And I was coming away. He says, here, will you have a drink with me? You're giving me a shilling. So I says, stuff it. I said, I can manage without that. I said, I can get 29 bob a week without doing anything, which would see unemployment benefit for an ex-soldier. But anyway, I finished up. I got an engineer got me a job at Carwiles drop stamping, and that was really work. I used to knock a pair of dies out with 18 pound striking hammer, head on it with this side, and you used to have to do them this way, you know. And I was there until they decided to sell out, and they sold out until the steel products at Tinsley, and that's when I joined the police force, you see.
And that was your career for the rest of your working life?
That was to be until 1946, when I retired off the police force. I've been retired 40 years. 40 years this year.
So, did you resent it sounds like you did, the way your employer treated you, the one who wouldn't give you a job,
well,
in a decent way?
Well, take it out now. I mean, and it's so many girls working for him as a machinist, you know. And I don't think really he could afford them to pay me probably £3 a week, £3.15 or something, whatever it was in those particular time. I mean, £3.15 in 1921, I mean, it was a lot of money then. I mean, policemen were only getting about, right up to 1919, when the Desborough scheme came in. They were only getting about 30 bob a week, you know.
So, although you refused to drink for them, you weren't really that surprised at what he'd done?
Well, I wasn't, no. I think he could have said, well, I'll give you a couple of quid a week. It'd have been 10 bob, and then I should have been on the dole, you see. But I should have had to work for that 10 bob. The remainder of what would have been if I'd have been on the dole. But you see, it wasn't that you didn't want work. The majority of people today, they're better off now than ever they were with not working. But on the other hand, it makes you think. When you retire, you've got plenty of time to think. You know what you're doing with your life. Probably could have done more with it. I was married, I've got three sons and a daughter.